Today's guest drew some recognition for her first book of poetry more than a decade ago. Then she set to work on another book of poems arranged around a central theme. That book became Incarnadine, and it won the 2013 National Book Award for Poetry. That shot recognition of Mary Shebist into the stratosphere. She's back here on Earth with us now and preparing for an appearance tonight in Ashland, sponsored by Chautauqua Poets and Writers at Ashland High School at 7:30. Mary Shebist has published two collections of poetry. Incarnadine is one. Granted is the other. Granted won an award for Mary for new writers. Mary lives in Portland and teaches at Lewis and Clark College and is our guest in the studio. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the pathway to writing poetry in the first place.
You know, I've always done it in some way. I don't remember a time when I didn't. But I think the real opening for me was when I was in high school, and I had a teacher introduce me to the poetry of Theodor Rethke. And I just fell in love with it. It was like nothing else I'd heard. And to me, it really resonated as almost a new kind of prayer, one that felt more true and vital and alive than the prayers I knew. And I wanted to be a part of that kind of language. And I think back now that, you know, Rethke was somebody who was from Washington, very much had a voice tuned by the Northwest. So I think there's something lovely about the fact that poetry has brought me to the Northwest.
I was about to say, so here you are living in the Northwest yourself. So interesting that you described it in terms of having heard the poetry of Theodor Rethke. So it came to your ear before it came to your eye?
I think so. It's a little bit hard to remember anymore, but it's the sounds that first captivated me. I remember, you know, taking that book out into the woods as a kid and reading it out loud, and I think it very much was about the sounds.
Well, I'm glad we're talking about this because we've had a discussion a few years back on the Jefferson Exchange with an author who provided a book about appreciating poetry. It wasn't so much about her own poetry, but pointed out that it really is something you need to hear. Poetry is best done out loud. And so when I hear you talking about hearing poetry, not just reading poetry, it resonates a bit.
Absolutely. I mean, it started, we had poetry before we had writing. So it very much started as an oral tradition. I mean, I think it's really wonderful now that there are so many different kinds of aspirations in poetry, and some poetry now is much more for the ear than others, but I certainly care about the ear.
It makes me wonder about process, though. I mean, for example, when you write, do you say things out loud and then put them on paper?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, or you know, sometimes I will write them down before I say them out loud, but whether or not they stay determines entirely on reading it out loud for myself and how it hits my ear.
Is this a very private process for you, something you do with nobody else around? Nobody
that
nearby?
Part I do alone.
A description of your poetry by several reviewers describes it as a spiritual poetry of spiritual and romantic longing. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
Sure. It's, you know, you don't go to, I don't go to poetry because everything feels right in the world. I go to poetry as a place to reach.
And is it reaching, you mentioned earlier about looking with the poems of Theodor Rethke for some new kind of religion. So, I mean, you were raised Catholic, I understand.
Yeah, I was. And, you know, I don't know if it's quite about looking for a new kind of religion, but I think it is, poetry, I think, is related to a kind of spiritual practice for me now, a sense of sitting down and being open to what you don't already know, a sense of that openness is part of what I go for.
Did you plan a central theme for either of the books, Granted or Incarnadine, or was it just a case of writing poetry and thinking, oh, well, these work well together, so I'll use these?
Yeah, no, the first book, Granted, I was not thinking about a theme at all. I was just writing poem by poem. And it was not until the very end of that process that I sat down and looked at the poems together and thought about how they might be arranged and speak to each other. And so at that end, I took some poems out that I didn't think really resonated. With the second collection, I started out just writing poems, but at some point early on, the idea of centering a poem around a collection around a central theme occurred to me and seemed a great challenge and opportunity. And that was part of what was exciting about a very different process with the second collection.
Please tell me I've pronounced it correctly. Incarnadine?
Well, both pronunciations are correct, but I tend to say Incarnadine. Incarnadine is also...
We'll come back and talk about Incarnadine or Incarnadine with Mary Shebist here on the Jefferson Exchange. She'll be appearing again tonight at 7:30 at the theater at Ashland High School, brought here by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. Don't forget, it is fall fun to drive time here in Jefferson Public Radio. We'd love to get your pledge of support to make sure that programs like this stay on the air. 888-552-6191 for a pledge of support by phone, or make that pledge online through computer, mobile device, or whatever's available, ijpr.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Mary Shebist, a poet and a teacher at Lewis and Clark College in the Portland area, and a guest of Chautauqua Poets and Writers. She's been brought to Ashland for an appearance tonight at 7:30 at Ashland High School. Two collections of poetry, Granted and Incarnadine, or Incarnadine, it can be pronounced either way, which won Mary the National Book Award for Poetry just last year. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You were just saying of Incarnadine, Incarnadine, that you realized as it was going along that this was something you could actually focus around a central theme. How did you arrive at the name, though, and what does it mean?
It means red or flesh-colored, and I arrived at it really through its resonance with incarnation, and it's really a book about what is incarnate in the world and the encounters that make things incarnate in the world. So I liked the title's resonance for that, but I also love that it's a color, right? To say incarnation is an idea, to say incarnadine is an actual color that is actually incarnate in the world. Before Shakespeare, it was largely thought of as flesh-colored. After Shakespeare's famous use of incarnadine in Macbeth, where Macbeth is trying to wash the blood off of his hands, and he fears that instead of the ocean cleaning his hands, the blood on his hands is going to turn the multitudinous seas incarnadine, turning the green one red. Since then, it's really been associated with the color of blood red.
All right, so that was a bloody red color. but a lot of other interviewers have asked about the fact that there's the red of incarnadine, and yet the book is a lot of blue, too.
Yeah, that's right. So the scene the book is centered around is the scene of the Annunciation between the angel Gabriel and Mary. And Mary is really the sort of obsessed over figure in the book. And she is typically portrayed in the colors of blue and red. So those are really the colors that play through the book. And I thought a lot about this idea from Carl Sagan when asked why the earth appears blue from space. He said, and why that cerulean color? The blue comes partly from the sea, partly from the sky. While water in a glass is transparent, it absorbs slightly more red light than blue. The red light is absorbed out, and what gets reflected back to space is mainly blue. And I love that idea that both are present, but one might get reflected back more. And so in the book, the color blue is the one that tends to get more often reflected back, but the red is threaded through and very present.
And the one absorbed in that sense?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Can we hear some poetry from Incarnadine to understand a little better what it is all about?
Sure. One of the things I tried to do with this scene is to use it as a lens to re-see contemporary kinds of encounters. And this is called Annunciation as Fender's Blue Butterfly with Kincaid's Lupin.
There are other similar titles, aren't it? Like Annunciation as Overheard from the Pantry or something?
Yeah, yeah. and another Annunciation that looks at an encounter between an endangered species and another animal is this one. Does. So the Fender's Blue Butterfly is endangered, and we thought it was extinct until fairly recently. And it only lives in Multnomah County in Oregon. Apparently its chances of survival would be increased if it was willing to attach itself to any other flower other than Kincaid's Lupin. But it sticks to that one, and I find that actually kind of moving. So this is Annunciation as Fender's Blue Butterfly with Kincaid's Lupin. But if I were that thing, my mind 1,000 times smaller than my wings, if my fluorescent blue flutter finally stumbled into the soft aqua throats of the blossom, if I lost my hunger for anything else, I'd do the same. I'd fasten myself to the touch of the flower. So what if the milky rims of my wings no longer stupefied the sky? If I could bind myself to this moment, to the slow snare of its scent, what would it matter if I became just the flutter of page in a text someone turns to examine me in the wrong color?
Mary Shebist reading her poetry from Incarnadine, Annunciation as Fender's Blue Butterfly with Kincaid's Lupin. This the butterfly is really saying, maybe I will go extinct.
Yeah, that's right. And it remains faithful. You know, I think one of the things about imagining this as an annunciation is a scene of beginning. And this is probably a scene of an ending. But that's, I think it resonates in a different way if you think this is maybe should be a kind of annunciation, but in our current world, it actually is probably more like an ending. And, you know, I really liked the resonance of, you know, the butterfly, like the angel, has wings. Women have been compared to flowers for as long as there's been poetry. So I'm picking up on that. But, you know, I'm also picking up on, you know, William Butler Yeats is a poet who really haunted this collection. And he had this really bizarre idea that every 2,000 years there's an encounter between the divine and the human that results in a birth that changes the world. So he thought of Zeus and Leda having Helen, who changes the world, and then Jesus changes the world. And Yeats was obsessed with this idea of it being time for a new era and what now slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. So, you know, it's not that I subscribe to that, but I still thought it was a question imaginatively worth asking in terms of what encounters are happening, what encounters are possible, and what are they engendering and making incarnate or not incarnate in our world?
That can almost blow your mind, trying to think about encounters between humans and the divine.
Sure.
So where to turn the conversation from here? The judges from the National Book Awards described Incarnadine as a religious book for non-believers or a book of necessary doubts for the faithful. Have you had people come to you and say, you know, I didn't read this book at first because I thought it was I thought it was just religious poetry, or people likewise saying, I didn't think this was religious and therefore I didn't read it, but I would have liked it to be religious poetry. Are people really interpreting it for their own purposes, their own spiritual quests?
I feel incredibly fortunate that I've had people on both ends respond to the book. I was up in the College of Saint Benedict a few weeks ago and spoke to quite a few nuns with whom the book resonated. But mostly it's been people from the secular world who have said, I'm not religious, that's not my thing, but there's actually a lot more here than I expected. And that's been, that's exactly what my dearest hopes for the book were, to sort of break down the sense of either I am a believer or I am not a believer, and we're in completely different modes and ways of being. I really wanted something that took some of the traditions I most loved from a religious prayer and meditative tradition and tried to carry them forward into really secular meditations and think about ways that things don't necessarily have to be left behind just because one is no longer fully in what one used to be.
No longer practicing religion,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah.
Mary Shebist is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of the poetry collection Incarnadine or Incarnadine. It can be pronounced either way, which won the National Book Award for Poetry in 2013. She'll appear at Ashland High School tonight at 7:30. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange now at 800-838-3760. Anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So here's a whole nother realm we can jump into, which is the idea of if you're not particularly religious, you can still see the Annunciation as, it's a great story.
It's a beautiful story. I don't know quite anymore what it means to say I am religious or not religious, or I am faithful or not faithful. Those increasingly become more complicated to me, and I don't feel like I have a simple answer. The Annunciation, I think in some ways it is a problematic scene for me in terms of how it portrays sort of what it means to be a good woman. And that's one of the things I deal with in the book. But it also seems to me a very beautiful scene in the way it suggests that a human can encounter someone or something really different, really unlike oneself, and not just sort of project one's own ideas onto what that other is, but actually hear and perceive something from that very different presence and be transformed by it. That, I think, is a really beautiful idea.
To begin from a place of not even necessarily understanding.
That's right.
The other.
Right. To be really open to something that you don't already know and don't already believe or think or understand, yeah.
Which, as has been proven many times, can be a little tricky for human beings.
It really can. It really can.
I'm just curious, though, about the different parts of your life and your experience here. The poem is about the Annunciation, but it's also about Fender's Blue Butterfly, which exists only in Multnomah County in the Portland area. Where other people might have thought, well, that's really cool that there's this butterfly that is just so stuck on this one plant that it will only be. But rather than make it a scientific search, it became a spiritual search and poetry for you.
Right, yeah.
Which is fascinating.
Yeah. Well, at some point I also realized that for me, these sort of scenes were so much with me and had so much shaped my imagination. It wasn't a matter of just being able to leave them behind or ignore them. So it was a matter of trying to create new relationships to them and to try to use them to expand my understanding and thinking rather than seeing them as limiting sort of stories that just have one moral, for example.
To draw out the context and the importance and share it with other parts of life.
That's right. You know, I love Flannery O'Connor when she's talking about faith. She says, faith will be the light by which you see, but it will not be what you see, and it will not be a substitute for seeing. And, you know, I think when I was younger, I really did treat faith as a substitute for seeing. I had the sense that I knew exactly what I believed and what I thought, and that everything I saw in the world had to find a way to fit into this frame I already had for it, instead of using these sort of great meditative traditions to actually get closer to the world.
Mary Shebus, the poet, our guest again on the Jefferson Exchange. The book is Incarnadine or Incarnadine. Was there a specific event or sequence of events that led you away from daily church practice, or was it just sort of a gradual growing up and growing out?
You know, probably a little of both. I mean, I think it was it's not been a simple trajectory. I've been in and out of, church practices throughout my life. But, in terms of faith, you know, when I was young, I had this very acute fear of losing my faith. It seemed to me this really precious thing that I wanted to hold on to, and I was very afraid of not keeping it. And I do have a very vivid memory of being a teenager, and one day it just felt like I couldn't hold on to it. It was like almost as if it left my body, and it was the saddest thing that had ever happened to me. And I so much wanted it back. But, you know, part of what I also look back on is I had a very simple idea of what faith was at that point. It seemed this sort of very pure and simple thing that couldn't even be really engaged with. And I more and more think that faith is a lot more complicated than that. And faith and doubt actually not only can exist simultaneously, but maybe even need to.
Do you have another poem from Incarnadine we'd like to go to?
Sure. This is Happy Ideas.
Okay.
And it begins with an epigraph from Duchamp, who is the artist famous for the ready-mades. And it begins with the epigraph, "I had the happy idea to fasten a bicycle wheel to a kitchen stool and watch it turn. I had the happy idea to suspend some blue globes in the air and watch them pop. I had the happy idea to put my little copper horse on the shelf so we could stare at each other all evening. I had the happy idea to create a void in myself, then to call it natural, then to call it supernatural. I had the happy idea to wrap a blue scarf around my head and spin. I had the happy idea that somewhere a child was being born who was nothing like Helen or Jesus, except in the sense of changing everything. I had the happy idea that someday I would find both pleasure and punishment, that I would know them and feel them, and that, until I did, it would be almost as good to pretend. I had the happy idea to call myself happy. I had the happy idea that the dog digging a hole in the yard in the twilight had his nose deep in mold life. I had the happy idea that what I do not understand is more real than what I do, and then the happier idea to buckle myself into two blue velvet shoes. I had the happy idea to polish the reflecting glass and say hello to my own blue soul. Hello, Blue Soul. Hello. It was my happiest idea.
Happy Idea is the poem by Mary Shebist from her collection Incarnadine, for which she won the National Book Award for Poetry last year. She teaches at Lewis and Clark College in the Portland area and will be at Ashland High School tonight at 7:30. We'll talk more with Mary Shebist and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us when we return. A reminder, too, it's Pledge Drive time, 888-552-6191 or online at ijpr.org. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Mary Shebist, who teaches at Lewis and Clark College in the Portland area, wrote the poetry collection Incarnadine, and won the National Book Award for Poetry for it last year. She's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll appear tonight at 7:30 at Ashland High School, sponsored by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, whoops, can't give that number anymore. It's all the same number, 800-838-3760, or just email us at jx@jeffnet.org. Are there poems in Incarnadine that are just sort of peripherally about the Annunciation? I mean, things that would have been fine in any collection and people would have said, oh, that's not about the Annunciation.
Absolutely, yeah. And I very much didn't want to do a collection that every single poem was the Annunciation. You know, there were a lot of poems I wrote that didn't make the collection because I didn't want any two Annunciations to be making the same moves. I wanted each one to be really different. Do you want me to read one?
Absolutely, sure.
Here is one that is very peripherally, it's about an octopus. Mm-hmm. But it's, I think, for me, it resonates in the sense of, again, a human relationship with something, a kind of creature very much not human.
Sort of like the meeting of the divine, right?
Yeah, the lushness of it. It's not that the octopus wouldn't love you, not that it wouldn't reach for you with each of its tapering arms. You'd be as good as anyone, I think, to an octopus. But the creatures of the sea, like the sea, don't think about themselves or you. Keep on floating there, cradled, unable to burn. Abandon yourself to the sway, the ruffled eddies. Abandon your heavy legs to the floating meadows of seaweed and feel the bloom of photoplankton, spindrift, sea spray, barnacles. In the dark benthic realm, the slippery nectin glide over the abyssal plains. And as you float, you can feel that upwelling of cold, deep water touch the skin stretched over your spine. No, it's not that the octopus wouldn't love you. If it touched, if it tasted you, each of its three hearts would turn red. Will theologians of any confession refute me? Not the blue cap salmon, not its dotted head.
And you end that with a smile, the lushness of it. You enjoyed that. You enjoyed writing that.
Yeah, I had some fun with that one.
Where do inspirations come from?
You know,
I mean, something you can put them walking in a tidal pool when you got that one.
Right. You know, they come from a lot of different places for me. Sometimes they'll start with just a bit of language in my head. Sometimes they'll start with an experience. Sometimes they'll start with a sort of problem and a need to try to write about it. And, you know, sometimes they'll start with a sort of sense of play. Here's this frame. What can I do with it that is going to take me where I didn't know how to be before? You know, I love Frost's no surprises for the writer, no surprises for the reader. So, you know, I write to surprise myself.
Well, and some of this, it seems like, is about certainly separating ourselves from preconceived ideas we had, things we've carried around for a long time, things like the faith we grew up with.
Right. No, that's right. You know, I love Blake says, expect poison from the standing water, which I really think has some truth to it, that if you don't mix things up and you just try to use the same frames through many different times and contexts, it can get tricky.
Unfortunately, my mind goes straight to the first Friday the 13th movie when she jumps out of the still lake at the end, but it wouldn't have been as exciting coming out of a choppy lake now, would it?
That's right.
More popular culture than you ever wanted in an interview about your poetry. One of the projects you brought in here is another version of your poem, apparently redone by students. Is that right?
Yeah, this made me so happy. This is from Kathy Bowen-Jones, period six. It's her high school period six creative writing class, who read my poem Happy Ideas, which I just read, and did a group version. They all wrote lines and collaboratively arranged them and put them together.
Well, this is fun.
Yeah, it was wonderful. I had the happy idea to find the positive in all this negativity. I had the happy idea to not let the little things bring me down. I had the happy idea to wear a fedora, but discarded it in favor of two-tone socks. I had the happy idea to race down the hallway and slide in my socks. I had the happy idea to climb a tree to sing to a bluebird. I had the happy idea that through war and politics, children wouldn't have to get involved. I had the happy idea to pretend that butterflies are fairies. I had the happy idea to fly. I had the happy idea to throw a tea party. I had the happy idea to spend my morning in a coffee shop. I had the happy idea to try to ice skate in my old Converse tennis shoes. I had the happy idea of scuba diving with my best friend. I had the happy idea of going to the lake and looking for treasure. I had the happy idea to sneak out of the house when my parents were not home to go visit my horse. I had the happy idea to let you go. I had the happy idea to ride a bucking bronco. I had the happy idea to collect leaves of every color. I had the happy idea to draw. I had the happy idea to dip my hand in paint and make a mess. I had the happy idea to take a bottle and turn it upside down, spilling its contents on the old worn rug in my grandmother's dining room. I had the happy idea to tell you the truth. I had the happy idea to light a candle and watch the flame flicker. I had the happy idea to form prayers out of everyday things. I had the happy idea to give myself more than 5 hours of sleep. I had the happy idea to go to bed 2 hours earlier. I had the happy idea to see the mysteries of the unknown, dragons flitting through the trees to pass the time. I had the happy idea of a new beginning around the corner.
That's some fun stuff. That's Mary Shebist reading the high school interpretation of I Had the Happy Idea. How many different kids involved in this?
I don't know. It's a
whole class, though.
It was a class that apparently collaborated on this yesterday.
Wow. Is there if there must be I Had a Happy Idea .com by now, or should be.
No. Not that I know of.
Right, well, there probably will be fairly soon. I'm curious about, there's obviously musicality in poetry.
Yeah.
Has any of your stuff been set to music? Have you considered bringing somebody in to turn your poetry into songs? Does it appeal to you at all?
Gosh, there was one composer who did contact me about the possibility, and I don't know if she's going to move forward with it. The idea is thrilling to me. I honestly have no idea how well any of these would work as lyrics, because I very much think of them as putting words together to create rhythm rather than writing something for a different music.
So is the decision made by the material in the sense that it shapes itself as you write? I mean, rather than, for example, saying, I'm going to do this one in this rhyming pattern and I'm going to do this one as blank verse, is it just dictated by what comes out of you as you go along?
You know, it actually works both ways. Sometimes I'll start with a subject or a sense of language and see what kind of rhythms or patterns seem to best fit it, and I'll try a lot of possibilities. But sometimes I will start with a pattern or a form and think, how will this shape put pressure on my thinking and my imagination, and to let the form sort of take the lead. You know, I always feel like my best hope for my poems is that the form can be smarter than I am, that the form or the rhyme or what I have to fill with the form takes me and puts pressure on me toward a new direction.
It applies structure, discipline.
It does, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about finding out that you were the nominee for the National Book Award. I mean, this is not something that comes along every day.
No. It completely took me by surprise, and I woke up when I was on the semifinalist list. I had no idea that it was the first year that they even did a semifinalist list. Mm-hmm. I had no idea that they were doing it. I had no idea when it was coming out or that I was even being considered. And I woke up that morning to several emails in my inbox saying, congratulations on the NBA. And my first reaction was, what's the NBA?
National Basketball Association.
That's what I thought first. Yeah. And I was very, so I Googled NBA. So that's how I found out. It was bewildering.
So when you went to the actual ceremony where you get to give your acceptance speech, did you know before you got into the room?
Absolutely not.
Really? Okay.
No. All of it was a thrill. And for me, the biggest thrill was getting to go and meet especially some other poets I'd admired for so long. And when I was standing in line to get in, it happened that I was standing behind Carrie Brownstein, who was there that night, and that was really fun to get to meet her. And she saw that the finalists all had to wear medals, and she saw it, and she said, "Oh, you're a finalist. What do you think your chances are?" And I said, "Zero. I really didn't think I had any shot at it." So it was a shock.
Well, congratulations on winning the National Book Award for Poetry, and thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Mary Shebus will be appearing at Ashland High School tonight at 7:30, sponsored by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. And again, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you, Jeff.